Hey, thanks so much for listening to this message. My name is Jason, and I'm one of the ministers here at the Madison Church of Christ. It's our hope and prayer that the teaching you hear today will bless your life and draw you closer to God. If you're ever in the Madison area, we'd love for you to stop by and study the Bible with us on Sundays at 5 p.m. or Wednesdays at 7 p.m. If you have questions about the Bible or want to know more about the Madison Church, you can find us online at madisonchurch.org. Be sure to subscribe to this podcast, as well as our sermons podcast, Madison Church of Christ Sermons. Thanks again for stopping by. I hope this study is a blessing to you.
I'm Karen Intrican, this is my, I think, third class, I believe, and my topic tonight is going to be on addiction. This is something that I find that's sort of close to my heart for a lot of different reasons. And so I hope that, you know, things that we go over tonight, maybe, you know, addiction is a very common problem in our society and also in the church with, you know, so we need to have a good understanding about what that process is so that we can minister to people, you know. I mean, we probably have it in our families. I'm not going to ask for a show of hands or anything like that, but, you know, it is very, very common. So I feel like that is just, you know, there's just a lot of things that make that a very debilitating disease, is what I call it. And one thing I wanted to start out with, remind me to have a prayer before we end, okay? I'll just go ahead and do that. I thought this picture was really good, and I apologize if you can't see it really good, but the quote here, and I don't know who it was from, I just pulled it up on the internet, but it says, sometimes the smallest step in the right direction ends up being the biggest step of your life. I think this picture kind of represents what people that really are trying to get out of addiction and in recovery, this is like what it feels like. You know, they see the light, but they just can't quite get it, and it takes little bitty steps over a long period of time. You know, they may have slips on the ice. They may have, you know, equipment that don't work, so to speak. They may, you know, have little falls or something, but they, you know, they keep trying to get, you know, to the light kind of thing. And so, you know, I think this is a really good illustration of, you know, what people, I think, deal with when they are, you know, struggling with addiction. Our objectives tonight, you can read them for yourself, but basically just to understand a little bit about the science of addiction, understand kind of some contributing factors, what causes it perhaps. There's a lot of different models of addiction. We'll go over just briefly a few of those. And just, like I said, the biggest thing is so we can have a little better understanding, you know, of what we're talking about here. I do know that, you know, does anybody think there's any references in the Bible to addiction just off the top of your head? Anybody? Not explicit, but if y'all remember in Romans 7, like around 15 to 20, when Paul's talking about the spiritual battle within the spiritual and the physical battle, and he's talking about how, you know, the things he knows he should do, he just can't do, and the things he doesn't want to do, he does. And that's kind of the dilemma. I'm not saying that's addiction. You know, the Lord's talking about addiction. But I do think that's a very good description on a biblical kind of terms about what it's like for people, you know. It's like they really, really want to, you know, some of them do. Some of them don't care about recovery. They don't really care. They're okay with what they're doing. But most people, once they embrace a recovery aspect of their lives, you know, they really try hard, and a lot of times they put all the stops in, but it's like there's this battle, and so we're going to understand a little bit more about the battle. Luckily, you know, the science has evolved from this ad. This is something that I don't even know. I pulled this off the internet, but it's an 1898 ad for advertising heroin as a non-addictive cough syrup, you know. You know, this is kind of what it's talking. It's like if you want to go to the jobber, which is a person back then that supplied merchandise and goods and stuff. So go to them and you can get some heroin, you know. So again, that's just, you know, it's funny, but yet, thank goodness, you know, things have evolved, right? You know, and we do have a lot, you know, now that there's technology to support the science and psychology of addiction. You know, we have fMRI scans that do real-time scans or other kinds of brain scans. We've got just all kinds of things that we can do, you know, blood tests, all these other things, and have an understanding of the way the brain works. And so it makes it important to, you know, understand those things on some level. This is some stats, and this is only stats. I like stats, but I didn't want to bore y'all. This is from drugusealabama.gov. This is a 2023 Madison County. Last year, it talked about basically out of all the arrests and legal, you know, things they had, this is basically the breakdown of, you know, what the drugs were that they were dealing with law enforcement. And, you know, fentanyl, y'all hear a lot about fentanyl. You know, it's funny, I've worked with fentanyl for 10 years. It's an anesthetic, really. It puts people to sleep. You know, anesthesiologists use it. That's why it's so deadly, you know, because that's really what it is. And so that surpassed, you know, methamphetamine's been kind of one of the big, and it still is a big problem in Alabama and a lot of other places, but it surpassed in about 2022. Fentanyl started coming around on the rise, and so now they're having to deal with that. You know, you may have heard that the law enforcement now, they you know, have Narcan shots. I don't know if anybody heard about all that. So a lot of the EMTs, everybody's doing that now, which is what's needed, you know, to keep them from, you know, arresting, respiratory arrest. But anyway, that just shows you a little bit of breakdown of that. You know, we've talked several times about triangles. You know, Becky loves triangles. I like triangles. You know, I think she'd mentioned about the triangle of conflict in one of her lessons. You know, I talked about in the cognitive behavioral therapy, the cognitive triangle, where you have thoughts, feelings, and behaviors that are kind of interlinked. Well, this is something I think if we can, you know, this is what we need to get an understanding of. And this is about stress management. And I'm not saying that addiction is, you know, stress management gone awry, but in a lot of times it can be, you know. Life gets overwhelming, people develop ways to cope with it, and sometimes these addictive processes give them an immediate relief from their whatever's bothering them, whether it's physical pain, emotional pain, depression, whatever it is. So it will give them a little bit of escape, but you know, it comes with a price. So let's just go on and talk about this. So what we got is there is some stress or pain. Like I said, it could be mental, physical, you know, emotional pain we're feeling. And then we just try to find a way to get away from it. You know, that's just human nature, right? We want to escape it. Some people like to avoid. You know, maybe they're in a bad marriage and they had a fight with their wife or something, you know, and so they're wanting to, you know, get away from that negativity, you know, that they're feeling. And so they, you know, one thing I found is the addiction clients that I've seen, one common thread in, I'd say 99% of them, is they lack emotional intelligence skills. They go from 0 to 100, you know, they exhibit anger, they exhibit depression, but it's like very much, they don't understand how to deal with negative emotions properly, you know, so that's what leads them down this path sometimes. And that's part of recovery in the later phases. You know, the first phase of recovery is getting them off of their substances. You know, that's a big deal, right? Takes a long time sometimes. But once they get some sustained, or you know, sobriety, then the next piece that, you know, they need is emotional, you know, intelligence skills, because that's a real prominent thing that causes relapse for people. So that's what we determine. But anyway, back to this. So we've got the relief, wanting to escape, and then people have positive ways to deal with stressors, and then here's some of the negative ways. There's a lot of other ones, you know. These are just some of the things I came up with, you know. Please understand, addiction is not just substances, you know. Food, porn, gambling, internet gaming addiction. That's probably going to be in the next DSM. I hope it is, anyway. But, you know, there's a lot of things we do that is basically, the brain treats it the same way. There's very little difference. There's little difference between a cocaine addict and a porn addict in the way their brain works. So, you know, once we get this understanding, you know, it's helpful to us to figure out, you know. Okay, so like the triangle of the stress management, this is just a little bit of the psychological addiction, you know, cycle is what I call it. But, you know, again, you've got at the top the emotional pain, the craving for relief. I mean, this is somebody who's already using. Like, let's say they already know that if they, you know, smoke some weed, you know, marijuana or something, that they're gonna get some relief, right? And so they have that craving. This is something that is intolerable for people sometimes, depending on their drug of choice. They get this preoccupation with the behavior or the substance. They start doing rituals, like, you know, they may can look at their, I mean, I hate to say this, but like their crack pipe, and they can almost, you know, just smell it, taste it, whatever, you know what I mean? And it gets them, you know, that's what's starting that dopamine in their brains. This preoccupation stage is really interesting in that there's a lot of delusional thinking that goes on in addicts' minds and people that have addiction problems. Delusional meaning, and y'all probably know this if you've ever, you know, had any in your family, you know, people that struggle. Like, they will say, you know what, they'll think, okay, I can just do it one time and it'll be okay. Or I can just go sit and have one drink and I'll be okay. You know, they have this rationalization. They minimize, you know, oh, I only had, you know, whatever, one hit of coke, you know, what's the big deal, you know. So there's a lot, if you can catch them and kind of tweak that later on once they get off substances, that's a big thing in recovery that I try to do with people. Because they have this kind of addiction in their brains telling them, oh, you know what, you're going to be okay. You're not going to get caught, you know, blah, blah, blah. And that's just part of what addiction does, and we're going to talk about that in just a minute because I've got some slides that shows a little bit of the brain and stuff. But it just, everything that is a rational parts of the brain, the cortex, the prefrontal cortex, the, you know, all these structures that are logical, you know, thinking processes through, those kind of things. When you have somebody that's addicted, that kind of goes offline, you know, and you know this if you've been around addicts, because it's like, how can you still use, and you've lost your job, you've lost your family, you've lost everything you have, and you're on the streets, but they still have to go, you know, and call the drug dealer. And it doesn't make sense to people. You know, it really doesn't make sense, but that is the nature of addiction. I mean, it really is. And I tell people a lot, if you have a drug problem, or, you know, if you're addicted to stuff, most of the time you either get better or you die. And these days, a lot of people die, you know, if it's drug related. I mean, I've just lost, I had a client last year, 22, he was a alcoholic, got him off alcohol. He started smoking a little marijuana. He died of fentanyl poisoning because his marijuana was laced with fentanyl. 22 years old. I mean, you know. So it's just, you've got to be careful. You know, it's just awful what's out there, really. Okay, I'm getting off track, sorry. Back to this. Okay, so you've got the preoccupation, the rationalization, and then they use. It's like, I've got to do this. I'm going to call the drug dealer. They know they're going to get that short-time relief, whatever they're escaping from, whatever they, you know, can't manage or whatever it is. And then they have negative, they feel bad about themselves on some level sometimes. And then that causes more emotional pain. They get depressed. They might have some shame. You know, there's a lot of shame involved with people that have long-standing addictions. The damage they've done to their relationships and all. And so that's a big thing. And so that all those negative things with their lack of emotional intelligence and how to deal with it, they just keep using. That's kind of the nature of it. What do y'all think about this? What factors might lead people to turn to drugs? I mean, we've already talked about, I guess, some of them, but anybody got any ideas?
Pain.
I'm sorry?
Pain.
Pain. Physical pain, emotional pain, yeah, yeah. You know, people get hooked on pain pills, you know. I mean, I've known quite a few people and Christians, you know. It's kind of hard, you know, it's kind of easy to do, you know. Because, well, now in Alabama, Doctors are not as likely to just keep writing the prescriptions over a prolonged period of time. They're going to send you to a pain management clinic or something like that. That you can thank the DEA for that. I think that's good in a lot of ways, but yeah, pain is a good one. Anybody else can think of anything else? I'm sorry?
Inclusion, like in a community group here.
Yeah, yeah. Like, you know, if your cultural, you know, norms are your peer group, hey, you know, we like to go to the bar and drink or whatever it is, go party, then yeah, you're going to be more inclined to do that. Yeah. Peer influences is a big one. That's on the end. Here's some other things. We know that kids, if they start using drugs, you know, 12 to 14, their brain is not, you know, it's just started, you know, kind of developing. It's still developing, really. I mean, from in that adolescent period. And so that's a really critical time for brain development in certain parts of the brain. And so we know that kids that do start using, depending on what they're using, that can be a lifelong, it can have lifelong implications, you know, which is unfortunate. So that's why it's really important for us as parents, you know, to kind of know, you know, keep kind of monitor what our kids are doing, things like that. But here's some other ones, you know, it talks about mental health. I do find a lot of times, and thank goodness this has been one of the things that has evolved over addiction medicine practices over the last 15 or 20 years, is that we now don't just treat the addiction, we treat whatever else is going on with it, a co-occurring clinic, disorders. You have co-occurring things that meaning maybe the person's got severe ADD, and because meth's a stimulant, they can focus on their job and work, and that's why they do meth, for example. So we know that there's people that kind of figure out among themselves, and I think it's really fascinating, they figure out sometimes what they need, their brain needs, in order to function, you know, based on, let's say if they're depressed, you know, they might drink, you know, a lot of people that drink, which is, you know, not a good thing because that's a depressant in and of itself. But sometimes they'll do stimulants because they understand it balances them out. It makes them feel a little bit better. So you can always tell, not always, but a lot of times by what their drug of choice is, that gives you a hint as to what, you know, kind of things are going on. All right. Here are basically protective factors or personal characteristics. Things in around the environment of the person that can help protect people from drug use. And of course, y'all probably know all these. They're kind of common sense. You know, if you've got a good connection with your family, not always is that, you know, but that helps, you know what I'm saying. If they have good skills, you know, how to problem solve, you know, adapting to change is a big one, you know. A lot of times people will be clean for a time, and then some major something happens, like maybe their parents die or something, and it sends them back in a tailspin. So that, you know, you've got to have that adaptability. The religious thing is huge for long-standing sobriety. It really is. I mean, the older I get, the more I realize that's a deal breaker for a lot of people. All right, so this is just something that talks about how, you know, the drink or whatever does do what it's supposed to do, which is numbs you, gets you out of whatever pain you're in emotionally or whatever. But of course, then we've got other things, you know, that happen too. You know, it leads to dependency, tolerance levels build up, and then, you know, we have to have more of the drug, and that's the way our brains work. Okay, so what I think the last statement there, what we know is that, and I mean this with all the love I can say, people in the church, they mean well, and we all, you know, try to help people and, you know, do the best we can do, but I think oftentimes we are under one of the older models about it's just a choice. You know, if you wanted to bad enough, you could stop. And in essence, that is true. I mean, everybody can stop, you know, if they want to. But as you're going to see in just a minute, it makes it really difficult because of what our brain's doing and our brain's telling us to do. And this is a brain disease. I mean, there's more and more evidence that supports the fact that it's not just, you know, free will and a matter of choice. You know, I hear spouses say, you know, I just don't understand why you can't stop doing this, you know. But it's really hard. I mean, it is an uphill battle for these people, you know. And we have to have a little compassion and empathy for these people. This is one of the slides, and I'm not going to go into a lot of detail, but basically what happens, and y'all probably heard me say this, is the midbrain, you know, you've got the cortex of the brain, the higher order functioning, you know, and then you've got the midbrain structures like the nucleus accumbens and all the receptors and things like that, cannabinoid receptors, other endorphins, all kinds of receptors in our brain. And if you think about it, what happens is dopamine, there's all kinds of, you know, neurotransmitters that get released. Mainly it's dopamine, but there's a lot of other things. Dopamine's the pleasure, you know, the pleasure chemical or whatever. But what happens is that, think about a hose, okay? Like, let's say if you've got a garden hose and you've got a cup, just a, you know, 8-ounce cup here. And let's say you're going to fill the garden hose, you know, fill the cup with the garden hose. You're not going to turn it on full blast, right? Because what's going to happen is, it's not going to land in the cup because the force of it is going to just, you know, go somewhere else. Over time, if you have something that's trying to contain the water that's not really solid, let's say, then it's going to kind of erode away, you know. And it's similarly, you know, you're going to want to turn it on slower. You're going to want to kind of drip it in or, you know, run it a little bit slower. That way it fills up and all that. But what happens is this dopamine and some of these other neurotransmitters, it's like they go berserk. And when there's the pleasure center is heightened in our brains, it floods those receptors with that dopamine. And the receptors over time can't handle it. There's even studies now that say that they actually, like, form different pathways to exit some of the neurotransmitters or whatever. But what it does over time is it desensitizes the neurotransmitters to that substance. And that, in essence, is what creates the tolerance in drugs. Why people have got to use more. You know, that is exactly what it is right there, is the receptors in the brain lose their sensitivity because the dopamine is so, you know, and other neurotransmitters are so flooding, and they can't deal with it. Okay, so that's basically all I'm going to say about that. But what happens is this system, the reward center of the brain, gets hijacked. That's basically what happens. And, you know, when we have a piece of chocolate cake or something and we love the way it tastes and it's the best chocolate cake we've ever had, that sends, you know, those dopamine receptors to our brain, you know. It can be a lot of other different ways. You know, sex does that, you know. But like I said, so that's the process, and that's what we're really fighting, and that's why we say it's a brain disorder. This is just some whatever you want to call it. But it basically shows this process where, you know, you've got like the executive function on the left. This is like a normal brain. And you've got all these, you know, bidirectional things where the, you know, certain parts of the brain are working in, you know, conjunction with each other and everything. And you see, especially, well, I don't have a pointer, but the one right here that's going to the SCG and the E, ACC is what it's supposed to be. That one right there, that is kind of the one that connects us, our ability to, our ability to process what's going on. In other words, allowing us to make good judgment about something, okay? So as you can see on the right-hand side, that becomes really, really thin. You know, it's like we've had this saying, you know, neurons that fire together, wire together. I don't know if y'all have ever heard that. I don't know. But the more repetition, the more habit, the stronger these things get. And so over here, you see that everything, look at the width of the you know, the reward center there, and it's going to the amygdala and all these, you know, midbrain structures. And like I said, we lose that sensitivity. And that's why you see people with certain drugs, especially like marijuana, different kinds of marijuana. They don't have any, you know, they don't have no drive. They just want to sit around and smoke pot all the time, you know. It's like it ruins that motivational center in their brain, you know, certain types do. So, again, that's basically what you know, drugs do. Okay, this is a slide, and y'all may have seen it. I don't know before. I know I use it a lot. But basically it shows that tolerance process. And on the left you've got kind of normal brains, you know, without drugs kind of thing. You see how the red, and that's kind of like, you know, high normal levels of activity there. And then when they're, depending on what the drugs is, you see the changes in the midbrain, and you know, there's not a lot of red there. And that's what happens. It just, you know, there's just not a lot going on there. So again, this kind of explains how these receptors on the right, they're just not really working properly, you know. I don't know if y'all can read that or not, but this is like this is about neuroplasticity, but what we know now is that some of the damage that people do due to substances or whatever can be repaired on some level. And that's what neuroplasticity is. It's the ability of our brains to kind of regenerate, form new neural pathways, you know, connect different neurons. We prune certain things, you know. These are the way our neurons do in our brain. So this is a good thing. But here we're seeing, again, the normal healthy brain on the left. And after 1 month of meth, you can see the difference. And then after 14 months with no meth, you know, it's almost back to normal. But 14 months, y'all, think about it. Meth's a bad drug. I mean, it's one of the worst. I've got this video, but I'm probably not going to see it. I'm show it because it's kind of, I don't know, a few minutes, and we're just going to skip through it. But basically what it showed is like a functional MRI, and it showed actually under a microscope these neurons forming and everything. If you want to look at it, you can look up Neural Connection 2 on YouTube, and that's where I got that from, but that's really interesting. Okay, these are some of the models of addiction, kind of past, present, and kind of now. This is the one where we talked about earlier where people just don't quite have a good understanding of it. They think it's a choice. They're like, why can't you stop this? You know, this is, you know, and they don't have a really good understanding about really what the struggles are with addiction. This is what, you know, you saw a lot back, you know, in the 1800s, you know, even up to 1950, really. The learning model, that's kind of what you alluded to when you talked about peer pressure, because, you know, it's like, oh, it's Friday, TGI Friday, you know, everybody get from the office, go do this. It's kind of like a paired stimuli, you know, meaning I'm gonna be social, I'm going to have fun, and I'm going to go, you know, drink at the bar or whatever, you know, with my buddies from work or something. And so that paired sense of stimuli gets, you know, kind of embedded and becomes a habit. So that's kind of one thing. And this one, I guess, doesn't have a lot of merit these days because it's not a matter of learning and unlearning necessarily. So that's just something kind of old school as well. What we kind of more think about now is this model, biosocial psycho or biopsychosocial model. And it just talks a little bit about all these different things that can influence people to have addiction problems, you know, and we talked about some of those earlier. You know, early drug, you know, what am I trying to say? I'm sorry, my brain's not, it's offline for some reason. Early introduction to drugs. That's, you know, families being okay with drug use. You know, those are things that can really set a child up, you know what I mean, for problems with that. Not necessarily, but that is a common thing. You know, if they don't have good access to medical care, you know, that's another thing. I mean, think about it. If you've got some bad problem with your leg and you don't have insurance, you know, you might be more inclined to go, you know, stand on the corner and wait for somebody to have some, you know, Vicodin or something. Yeah, I don't know. But this has kind of got some merit. Here are some other factors that are influences in addiction. We do know that kids, I'm going to kind of be Becky for a second. Kids, when they have early trauma of a significance, it can kind of wire their brains a certain way, you know, and kind of set them up for potential challenges down the road. And so that's something we really need to pay attention to. And I will say this, you know, vaping is a big thing now, right? Vaping, you know, people think it's harmless. People think it's not a big deal. Well, it really is a big deal, you know. If people knew what was in those things, you know, I mean, there's metals in there, you know, nickel, chromium, there's lead in some of those things, and people are inhaling those things and getting in their lungs. There's all kinds of plastic residues in some of them. So again, that's not something we need to be, you know, they may not have nicotine. Some of them have nicotine, which is a stimulant, but like I said, that's not a good thing. You know, they say, oh, it's just water vapor. No, it's really not. Most of them, about 98% of them, that's not the case. Does anybody have any questions about any of these? I mean, I guess the point of this is there is a lot of things that can lead somebody down the path of addiction. You know, if you have all these, that don't mean you're going to have a problem. I mean, we still have free will, so to speak, and it just, you know, but this is things that we look for in trying to understand the why. You know, why did this person, you know, what happened in this person's life that made them, you know, do these things, you know? And a lot of times it's a lot of things like that, you know? Okay, one of the things I try to do, and this is just a short little blurb about addiction counseling, is, you know, once they have sustained sobriety over a period of time, after they get through the withdrawal process of whatever their drug is, and that depends on the substance, how long that is, you know, the process. But this is something, is a big thing that we have to teach people. Relapse prevention is huge because, you know, you want them to have an awareness of, you know, hey, you know, what are some of the things that potentially could get me back using again, you know? Well, I do a lot of little exercises kind of with them, not, you know, like three circle stuff and different things, but we need to have an understanding of what makes me want to use. You know, what is it? Is it when I feel unfulfilled in my marriage? Is it when, you know, there's just a lot of different things it could be, you know? So my point is, it's really important that they have an awareness. And what I see a lot of times, not always, because I'll have people that'll say, you know, my car just drove itself to the liquor store. I don't know how it happened. You know what I mean? But usually, if they can really give some thought to it, stuff happens kind of in sequence. Not all the time, but usually what happens because of this lack of emotional intelligence, emotional triggers are a big relapse cue for people. Meaning they do have a fight with somebody, or they, you know, they get angry at their boss, or they get fired, or whatever it is, you know, something happens and they have this negative energy and negative emotion, and, you know, whether it's anxiety, whatever it is, and they feel like they've got to, you know, look outward to deal with it. You know, it's like, I've got to do something. I've got to have a substance. I've got to, you know, get on my computer. I've got to do this. And so that, you know, they have to learn those emotional skills to prevent relapse. And then if you don't, if you have this negative energy, this negative feeling or emotion, and you don't take care of it, then there's certain things you can do to take care of it. Is you go into this mental relapse where actually you start planning. You know, how can I do this and not get caught? You know, I mean, maybe somebody's going to be, you know, out of the house and I'll have a little time, and, you know, or I might can drive to Mississippi and pick up something, or, you know, making it. They start planning, and kind of that starts becoming part of that, you know, I'm going to see how I can make this happen kind of thing. That's a very dangerous part. You know, you want to try to nip any progressive relapse problems in the bud, the earlier the better. But of course, if you can't take care of yourself, you know, if you can't, you know, learn how to deal with, you know, emotional regulation, and you're thinking about all this deceptiveness you're going to be doing and how you can get away with it, you know, and your brain's telling you, oh, yeah, I can do this, you know, and she'll never find out or whatever, then they're going to be doing something. They're going to be, you know, standing on the corner, you know, they're going to be calling a drug dealer. They're going to be doing all that. And the physical relapse, it's like it's too late by then, you know, because if you've already made up your mind to do it, then you're probably are going to do it. Not always. But so like I said, this is part of what I do, is try to allow people to understand what are their really, you know, what is your life like when things are good? You know, we identify those things like, oh yeah, I'm plugged in at church. You know, I'm enjoying my family. You know, I'm whatever these things are. You know, I'm taking care of myself. And then we talk about, well, what are the yellow things? You know, what are the things that maybe are caution? You know, if I have these things occur in my life, then I need to be careful. You know, and that's how they kind of, you know. And then there's the things in the middle that are, you know, if I'm doing these things in the middle, like I stop going to church, I stop going to my 12-step meetings or talking to my elder or whatever it is, then that's going to let them know that they're in danger of relapse. There's a lot of groups, and I'm not pushing 12-step, but I do think it can help people. There's a huge amount of 12-step groups in this area. We're fortunate in that way in Huntsville, Madison. I do think that a lot of these groups have merit. I think Al-Anon is one, or Nar-Anon is for narcotics, family members of people that have you know, opiate addiction and things like that. But I think families need support during this time. You know, I always tell people, you know, addiction is not just the one person, it's a family disorder, you know. And there's different things we can do as a family to influence our addicted person to seek help and motivate them for change. And there's some things that we can do that perpetuate the cycle of addiction, you know, and enable, is what some people say. So again, we have to know as a family how to optimize that process for that person if we have influence over them still, and we may not. But like I said, there's a lot of good books and stuff out there. I did bring a few. But Al-Anon is a program for family and friends of people that have, you know, alcohol disorders. And here's some of their basic premises. They teach that it's not your fault, basically. It's not your fault that you have a husband that drinks, you know. And basically they focus on the family member, them having a healthy detachment stance, meaning they didn't cause it, they can't contribute, and they can't cure it. So they're going to love that person, but they're not going to tolerate, you know, there's going to be some boundaries there. So they try to focus more on the family member, which I think is good, because I mean, I think that's needed. COSA is one group. There's other groups that are partner groups, but they have this is kind of old school, but they have this co-addict mentality, meaning like if your husband has a drug problem, then you as a wife, you're a co-addict, you know. And honestly, it can be true. But what I find is a lot of the things that they used to accuse the spouses of, meaning the hypervigilance, like I'm making sure they're going to their AA meetings, and I'm making sure they're coming to church, and I'm making sure they're not spending money. A lot of that stuff is kind of a PTSD thing for spouses, you know, because a lot of times I find this is a traumatic experience for family, especially spouses, you know. I mean, and so a lot of that, I don't necessarily buy into the codependency, co-addict thing. It does apply to some people, for sure. But I think this is kind of, like I said, a little bit of old school, the way we look at families. This model, the Kraft model, is based on, and I can't think of their names. Oh, man, I'm running late. Based on, this is Beyond Addiction is the name of the book. And it talks about the family. It's like a family retraining program is the way they kind of label it. But basically, it's like, how are we going to optimize this person's success in our family? And we're going to balance emotional support and, you know, listening and doing what we can for that person. But we're also not going to allow them to, We're just going to allow the natural consequences of their disease to occur. Meaning, you know, if it's 4 a.m. and they hadn't came home yet, well, we're just, you know, or whatever time it is, you know, we normally go to bed at 12, we're going to just lock them out of the house, you know, because we're not going to leave our front door open. We're not going to wait on them, you know what I mean? So it's almost like we understand that natural consequences in this model is helpful to motivate people, you know? I mean, if I'm not saying this is wise, but let's say you've got a spouse and, you know, her husband comes home drunk for the umpteenth time in a row and she just takes all his clothes and throws them out on the front lawn or something, you know. I mean, like, she's had it, you know. So again, I'm not saying that's good, but the problem is, it's like taking car keys away from somebody you know that's inebriated, you know. I mean, this is the kind of thing the spouses and families have to deal with. And so they try to help them. They try to do what they can, emotional support, listen to them, you know, try to help them problem solve and all that, but they don't, they just kind of let things happen. If they get busted and they have to go to jail, well, they might just have to go to jail. You know, you don't try to get them out, that kind of thing. As far as the church, this is the last time I know that. Was that the first bell? Okay, we're going to have to hurry through this, I'm sorry. On the left-hand side, these are, you know, basically three areas. This is information I got from Don Umphrey, some of his writings with Quarry Press. I don't know, he's a Christian guy that has written a lot of books for prison ministries and stuff. But he basically talks about there's three types of people, members that have addiction challenges with them, those that are in recovery on the end. You know, those are, you know, that have it in the family and those that are struggling themselves. And it talks about some of the characteristics of the left on these people. Like, you look for people that are kind of on the fringe of the church. Not to say that if they're introverts, they've got an addiction. I'm not saying that. But sometimes they just don't quite fit in sometimes, you know, and they seem like they're not really, you know, they maybe leave really quick or, you know, whatever it is. So anyway, on the right-hand side, it talks about maybe some potential suggestions on how to approach them, you know, what to say to them, basically, you know, those kind of things. So I do think one thing I do want to mention is this on the top, avoid poor timed interventions and shooting the wounded mentality is what I call that. Because, you know, if somebody's in a crisis and, I don't know, we're, you know, again, we mean well, but sometimes if we don't have a good understanding of what they're really struggling with and all the challenges, we might say, oh, you know, you just need to pray harder. And not to say that God can't wipe this sin out of their life. I mean, obviously he could, right? But that's not really helpful to them when they're in a crisis. You know what I mean? Sometimes we have to be attuned to, I mean, they know what the scriptures say, these Christians that have these addiction problems. They can quote it. It's just they can't live it, you know. So us telling them these things they already know sometimes isn't really helpful. And I'm not saying it's right or wrong. I'm just saying sometimes the interventions need to be timed where if we're going to talk to somebody, we need to, you know, just choose our words carefully because the worst thing we can do, I think, as Christians is to proceed, you know, like a judgmental stance, you know. They don't need to be judged. They already, trust me, they're hard enough on themselves, most of them are. So we just, you know, we don't need to be punitive in how we respond to these people. And basically, the rest of this is talking about how we can help people. Educate yourself, you know, understand that people have a lot of denial when they're in addiction. You know, they don't want to admit they got a problem because then they got to do something about it, right? But if you're somebody you love has a problem, you being in denial too is not going to be helpful, you know? And that's the hard thing that families have to deal with. It's easy to be in denial, you know? It's easy. Turn a blind eye. But that's not helpful, you know what I mean? It makes the cycle go longer. They get more involved in it. And it makes it much worse sometimes. You know, and I'm just going to let y'all read through some of these. I think asking for help's big. Anybody here at church, I mean, Becky's has training in addiction. You know, we've got a ministerial staff here that can do some counseling. You know, we all, We don't want people to, if you're really struggling or have somebody in your family that's you're really concerned about, you know, please call. You know, I'll have my contact stuff at the end, but, you know, I do see this as a, you know, it's just not going to go away. I mean, it's just, there's always going to be this challenge and it's getting worse. So I think, you know, please don't suffer in silence. You know, it's easy to do that, but it doesn't really help. I do think about sometimes, you know, us good intended Christians, we will not think things through because we think we're doing the right thing. You know, I remember I had a dad one time that his son, adult son, was, I don't remember what his drug of choice was, but he was like riding him around to go to the drug dealer and get it. And then there was like meeting somebody and there was a prostitution ring involved at that hotel. And I'm like, why are you doing this? You know, why are you putting yourself in this terrible situation where you could potentially get arrested? You know, and so we have to really think about those kind of things. We don't want to ever do anything that's going to harm us, you know, if we can. I guess that's really, I mean, like I said, it's just more of the same. I do tell families you got to trust your gut. You know, addicts are very good con artists and they're manipulative and, I mean, they're very intelligent and they know how to work, you know, everything. And so they're going to tug at your heartstrings. You know, they're going to say, you know, I can't pay my water bill. You know, I need $50, you know. And I mean, what do? You give them money. That's the worst thing you can do for an addict is give them money. I mean, everybody knows that. I mean, you know, you just don't give them money, you know, because, again, if they're in active addiction, they're not going to do what they say they're going to do with it. They're going to use it other ways. Okay. This is about hope, and I just want to mention that, you know, despite the fact that addiction is such a debilitating disease for not only the individual but the family, there is a lot of hope. There is a lot of success stories. You know, and some people don't agree with this, but they have medication-assisted therapies. That's another thing that's come down the pipe. You know, it's been there a long time, actually, with methadone and some others. But, you know, we do have things now that are helpful to people, you know, especially with opiate addiction, to cut down on the withdrawal process, because that can be brutal for people, you know. And I'm not saying it's a good thing. I'm not saying it's a bad thing. I've seen it work good for some people, and I've seen some people abuse it. So, you know, I just think, though, that it is something to consider. I think it's the biggest problem with that, I think, is people, the families, tend to think that it's just, you know, changing one addiction for another. Like, you know, I'm getting off, codeine or, you know, whatever, but Suboxone, yeah. I don't know why it skipped my mind. But, yeah, and they don't think that's a good thing. You know, the families are like, well, that's just, you're still addicted to that. Well, no, not really. They're medically supervised for that. Most of them have monthly appointments, and they, you know, they do pretty well with it. This is other things about hope. Isn't it, you know, and this is just some, there's my contact information. I know our time's up. Anybody have just a quick question? I'm sorry I ran over. I just love this topic.
I have an observation.
What's that? Yeah, this is my mother, y'all, Margie Weston. I don't know. Yeah.
I think a lot of times we as Christians look down. We won't be involved.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And as you brought out in these lessons, we need to be involved. We need to be more compassionate. And a lot of times, we say, well, you know, they create the problem, they'll fix it. We don't give them the time of day, so to speak, a lot of times. And it's a fault of ours.
Well, it's a fault, but also it's like their trust has been burned so many times. It's a mode to protect yourself. Families think, I just can't go through this again. And you do. A lot of times with chronic addiction, you get to that point where you just like, I can't do this anymore. I got to get off this roller coaster. But you're right. I do appreciate that comment. I do think that is, you know, but it is a struggle. And I don't know anything else. I mean, I know our time's up. I hope y'all got something out of this. Here's my contact information. Oh, Becky, what was that announcement you said?
If they have any questions.
Oh, if you have any questions, next week is our last ladies class time. So if you have any questions, submit them to me or Becky or Sandra or whoever, and you know, we can go through some of those. But we are going to be discussing fair fighting communication next week, so you know, that'll be good for people that are have a relationship. So all right, take care. Thank you very much.